Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to an episode of Mosaics, the Chronicles of CTR Current Events program. I am here in Boston with a very good friend and an all-time practitioner, Bill Wooding, who since 1978 has been the owner of Wooding's Garage in Alston, Massachusetts. Bill was one of the coordinators of the Dharma Dhatu in Boston, and he is currently a coordinator for the Sadharma Association.
Past.
He was a coordinator. Until recently, he was a coordinator of the Sadharma Association. And he was one of the founders of what was known at a time, as the Queer Buddhist Fellowship, which in Boston has become the LGBT Meditation Group in Boston. Bill has also been a very dedicated practitioner and friend to many of us, and we are right here in his apartment in Boston in May of 2013. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
Bill, how did you meet Trungpa Rinpoche?
Okay, that goes back to the early 70s, when I had just freshly returned from a one-year overland trip to India, and it was kind of the Ram Dass trip, the Be Here Now trip, that me and my then partner, Michael, took as a 13-month round trip overland to India and back. And at that on that trip, we were introduced to and exposed to Buddhist culture in its home ground. And that was, you know, after college years of having read Buddhism through Alan Watts and others, and take an interest in spirituality. Then coming back to the States after that, and the Vijayadara was already here teaching at that point, kind of freshly, newly. And he was making his connections with people like Allen Ginsberg and other high-profile people who pointed the way to him. And for me, a few things happened. One was, I met up with an old friend of mine, Jamie, who had a kind of a magical relationship with me in that he often pointed the way to me spiritually. He originally pointed the way to me to Maharishi, the meditation teacher. So when I came back from India in the early 70s, one thing that happened was that I met up with Jamie, and he again pointed the way, and he said, "Oh, you've got to hear about this Tibetan teacher. His name is Rinpoche. And he never says, don't do this or don't do that." I said, "Oh, that sounds interesting." And he says, "In fact, he's going to be giving a talk next week at the Arlington Street Church." So I said, "Okay, I'll go to that." And I did. And Beth Gordon, now Beth Rinsler, introduced Rinpoche, who to me then looked like an MIT professor. And I wondered what all the fuss was about.
What year was that?
This would have been 73.
Okay.
Yeah, at the Arlington Street Church. And Rinpoche was wearing a vanilla-colored suit, and with his glasses and everything, he looked so conservative, you know, like a Japanese nerdy guy or something. And then, on top of that, when it came to discussion and questions and answers, I felt things sounded a little bit weird in the sense that people were addressing him in very religious tones, and it just altogether struck me as a little bit strange. So at that point, I didn't feel a real connection with Rinpoche himself or the situation he was creating. But what did happen, however, at the same time, was that Beth Gordon and a few other people were forming the Dharma Dhatu down on Charles Street.
Anna
Beacon
Taylor
Hill.
And
yeah.
Bob Morehouse?
Bob Morehouse, Anna Taylor. And me and my partner, Michael, started going to that because we also, at that time, had started reading Rinpoche's books, Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism. Now, that was one trend that happened, pointing me toward Rinpoche. The other thing was, simultaneously at that period, the whole gay world was churning out various little newspapers and tabloids, one of which was called Gay Sunshine. And I read it from time to time and stopped on an interview with Allen Ginsberg where he talked about his relationship with Rupa Rinpoche. And I said, oh, that's the guy we just went to see the other night. And I read it, and I was very interested to hear that Ginsberg asked Rinpoche what he thought about being gay. And Rinpoche had replied something to the effect, he didn't see any problem with it as long as people had genuine communication. Which gets into another kind of question we could talk about if we want to.
What is genuine communication?
What did he mean by genuine communication? I think I have an idea now, many years later, what he meant by that.
Okay. We'll come back to that.
Okay. And I thought, oh, that's interesting that he has an openness to gayness, and he's got this reputation from many quarters of being a genuine teacher, and he has written these very interesting books. So all of this was adding up to me to being much more and more interested in him and finding that the Dharmadhatu thing with the open houses, the discussions, listening to his talks, hearing talks from visiting students like Robin Kornman and other people from Karma Choling, then called Tail of the Tiger, would come down to Boston and give a talk, or sometimes we would listen to a Trump Rinpoche talk, and there would be discussion and there would be a lot of interaction between fellow spiritual practitioners or travelers or interested people. And the situation to me was very magnetizing. So that really had a lot to do with drawing me personally in. The fact that the Vijayadhara was open to all dimensions of people's identities, including gayness, and that he had created a very open situation of communication, which was very non-doctrinal and kind of fun. Now, another thing that went along with this was that it became very evident after a while being in this Dharmadhatu group that there were a lot of gay guys in the group. And that was another piece of it. You know, that meant like I had, it was kind of a sexy situation. You know?
Instant super sangha.
Yeah. Yeah, there was like a lot of fun to be had there. And so, by must have been his genius, he was creating a world in which people could come as they are. And there were no barriers put up by doctrine. And that also, by the way, included the acceptance of drinking, which would have been unheard of in most spiritual communities. So it was the open doors, in many, many ways, that opened doors that brought me to the Vijayadhara. Then it was more like over a period of time, years, of being more and more exposed to him personally, his teachings, that I began to appreciate him as a teacher, and eventually as my teacher. That's really how that came about.
What happened to your partner? Did he connect with the Dharmadhatu at the time, or that was just not his...
Interestingly, that actually became the source of our breaking up, because I was taking more and more interest in Trungpa Rinpoche's world, in the Dharmadhatu, in the community, in the practice, in the Nimtuns, eventually in Datun, whereas my partner then, Michael, was becoming having his doubts about it all. He felt threatened by that situation. And he became more and more defensive about it, and it became a split for us, because I was saying to him, I wanted us to go on this journey together. He was saying, I don't want anything to do with this crowd. They're all a bunch of nuts. and they're all too theatrical. And he tried to make friends with the situation, but it just went against his grain too much. And he was at a party once where Jay Nagarajan,
yeah.
Naga,
yeah.
poured milk over his head because because Michael was so uptight and made some kind of a negative remark. And And the insult just piled on insult upon insult to Michael, to the point where he really wanted to leave, didn't want anything to do with that community, at a time when I was becoming more and more involved with it. And this became a crisis between us personally, to the point where I felt like I had to actually make a choice. And I made the choice to go closer to the Dharma. And what happened was that then I moved away from Michael and moved into the Dharmadhatu resident house in Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
And that really was our split.
Around what year was that?
That would have been 73, 74.
Mm-hmm. In Upland Road.
Upland Road, Cambridge.
Extraordinarily beautiful house.
Right.
With a lot of different people. And that's actually when I came into the Boston Sangha around that time, after the 73 seminary. And it was a pretty wild scene. I mean, it had lots of meditation and lots of classes and so on and so forth, but the nightlife associated with being a Dharmadhatu member was quite extraordinary.
Right. Yes, we were party central. And then eventually we expanded into another house and another house. There were three resident houses for this community when as time went on. So that by the late 70s, we had three resident houses.
Mm-hmm.
And one of which was really, that's when the art of partying reached its peak, was at the Hillside House in Cambridge. And we had a lot of space to dance there.
And also, I mean, it became sort of more probably extreme a little bit later in the 80s, too. But they were, as far as the gay community, this was the time of late 70s, early 80s, the explosion of the disco set.
Oh, right.
You know, I mean, sort of, you know, Gloria Gaynor and the Bee Gees and, you know, lots of discotheques in town. Both men and women, and together.
Yeah.
And it seemed to me to be so part of, you know, you would practice, you would study, you would do your dhatuns, you would do your seminaries, and then you could definitely party.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about drinking, I imagine that if you had had a spiritual community where drinking wasn't allowed at that time, it would have been very difficult for the gay community, because this was also tied up with the bars and the... Because of our age, right? We were in our 20s and early 30s.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a time when you needed to be letting off a whole lot of steam. And think of the people who couldn't have hung in there with a tighter spiritual discipline.
Mm-hmm.
We needed a very, very loose container.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the uniqueness of what the Vajradhara had created for us. So, for example... 1975, my first Dhatun held at J. Peak, Vermont. We partied like crazy there when the party time came. And then we were back on the cushion the next day. But the fact that we were able to get in cars and drive down the road to the local bar and just party the hell out of it, you know, on the day offs in the middle of Dhatun was really, really unique. Thing about our world, you know, and I think it had a whole lot to do with making the path possible for us.
Yes, and the famous end of Dhatun parties, almost in every Dhatun, there was great parties for some reason after everybody been sitting for a month. And I remember in 1978 seminary Jyotara saying something about the mind of his students can be very precise until you turn on Saturday Night Fever and then it just lose them. One of the interesting things probably that people don't know as much is how many of the well-known figures in our community internationally were actually gay. Like the Vajra region was actually gay, and there were a number of members of the board of directors and Dharmadhatu, but it was actually gay men. There were really no gay women.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you can...
At least not high profile.
Well, even low profile. They just didn't seem to exist. There were very, very few gay women, but a lot of gay men.
Yeah.
Did you ever have an opportunity to speak to the region or to anybody about being gay on the path at that time?
Not the regent. never came up with him and me. We never had that level of personal conversation. Craig Smith and I talked about it a lot.
Mm-hmm. Craig Smith being another one of the founders of the Queer Dharma.
Right.
What did kinds of conversations did you and Craig have?
Well, you're asking about the characteristic of being gay in the Sangha,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And where it fits and its acceptance. And like, let me give you an example. At least in my case, I had an opportunity to talk to the regent. And I said, well, sir, everybody's trying to push me to get married and have babies, right? And that's just not really where I'm at, right? I'm gay. And he said, oh, well, misery loves company. Sort of undercut my entire preoccupation about, you know, the pressure to beget.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to Trungpa Rinpoche one time about it also.
Uh-huh.
And he said, well, it's no particular problem. I mean, it may be more difficult for men in terms of finding some ground. It's easier for women. You know, women sort of, you know, the joke about, you know, you bring the U-Haul on the second date. You know, they're more established in terms of finding some ground, which seemed to be the sense of why pairing up in the long term might be a good idea, whether it be open or closed relationship. But those are the two reference points that I've had with the two of them. And, and you know, nobody...
Yeah. Well, the Vijayadhara's words about gayness varied a whole lot over the years, very much. And on the one hand, all the doors were open and there was a welcome come as you are, on the one hand. On the other hand, once you were invited in, then he didn't mind needling you and poking at your identity.
Mm-hmm.
And that came indirectly. I mean, I never got personally needled by him about gay. But, you know, he did at times make statements and answer questions that some people found upsetting.
Do you recall any?
Such as in Boston, one year he was here teaching, and Alan Berger asked a series of questions about the position of his Shambhala vision about various subjects, such as the equality of women, and he went on to answer about how it was a meritocracy, right? The equality of gays, and he took the opportunity at that point to say a few words about the gay identity. And he said, you know, these people, gay people, seem to not want to experience the
boring
messiness of dirty diapers and things like that. And there was a general feeling that he wasn't pampering the gay identity.
Is that part of dirty diapers pampering?
Yeah. Yeah, he wasn't playing up to the gay identity here. He was actually raising questions, and he was basically saying that it was, he wasn't raising it as a problem, but he was saying, you know, just like every other human identity that he talks about, they all have two sides. They have a workability side and they have a questionable side. And he was raising the questionable side of the gay identity, let's put it that way.
Yeah, he never pandered to identity politics. It
not
was very
least,
interesting.
Not at all.
That he,
so that kept a little fire under everything.
Uh-huh.
It meant like you weren't cool. You weren't automatically okay just because you now come into his world.
Mm-hmm.
You have come into his world, and now you could be cooked a little bit.
Yeah,
you know?
And at some point you had to deal with the dirty diapers of your own mind, I think.
That too.
Right.
Yeah. So some people took offense at that kind of thing. And they said, well, he's obviously going on this trip now where he wants everyone to become, you know, a husband and wife family raising children in the Shambhala vision. And the acceptance of gays is now going out the window.
Mm-hmm.
And some people actually were talking that way.
Yeah.
Having, you know, kind of, in my opinion, overreacted to some of the things that Rinpoche had said.
Well, there was peer pressure to settle down.
Yes.
Stop partying and settle down. And even you could party inside your relationships. Not that any of those relationships lasted, a few lasted and a few didn't, but there was this kind of like hurry up and beget, right? Get married and beget.
Yeah.
And get established and see what happens.
Yes.
And
he said to Ginsburg, don't you want to see any little Ginsies running around?
Ginsy probably went, no. Oh, God. So, no, that's why I went to talk to the region. It's like, oh, my God. You know, I just don't want to, what did I call them? I just didn't want to be pushed into, you know, some kind of person who's going to save my life, you know, whatever. So I just went, I'm out of here. Like, I left Boston. I mean, left Boulder and moved to Boston and New York. But I never followed any, it was more, I think it was sort of, we're a very peer pressure community, right? We go through things. Now everybody's trying to figure out how to die well, right? It's like the latest thing, you know, how to die well, whatever that means, you know? Like, first it was how, you know, how to birth well, now we're going to die well. But I mean, it is, I think in general we can say that there was no, that though there was tremendous accommodation for a come as you are, there was no necessarily pandering to a don't solidify who you are.
Right.
No matter who you were. If you were too Jewish, if you were too Italian, if you were...
He'd be sure to find a way to make fun of it.
Torture you.
Yeah.
I mean, the amounts of different kinds of tortures that he would, you know, poke on his students, no matter what their thingy was, to drive them nuts.
Right.
But nevertheless, I mean, they're over time, I guess, with the rock stardom of Pema, the Shambhala community became populated with many gay women.
Mm-hmm, true.
Like, Hubbardson, there were hundreds, mm-hmm. hundreds of gay women. Mm-hmm. And I think Pema
many
had
of whom
to do.
Now populate our gay group, gay Dharma group.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them have come to this group out of being first exposed to Pema's teachings.
Yeah, it was very interesting. All of a sudden it changed. And also, I think a lot of the women's movements, eventually, some of it developed the gay women's consciousness, and that became more obvious. I don't know what had happened in the 70s. There were none, really. I mean, a minuscule number of gay women on the path that you would know about. Right?
Yeah.
Tell me about the founding of Queer Dharma with Craig. I mean,
okay.
Where did
that
come from?
Now fast forwards to the early 2000, around 2000 and the early 2000s. And Craig at that point had Craig Smith, well known in the Sangha as the Mudra Space Awareness teacher, primarily, although Craig had also led a number of Dhatuns by then. He was very visible in the Sangha as a teacher, meditation teacher, and Dhatun leader, and a very theatrical person who
looks like a Garuda.
Yeah, who loved to display his gayness.
And he had very, very big eyebrows.
Yes, and still does.
Still does. And he's Shelley Pierce's brother.
That's right.
And Craig is also a very well-established and respected business consultant in issues of corporate citizenship and the digital divide.
That is right, yes. And he's presently living in Asia, and he's doing that type of consulting with governments, with
mm-hmm.
Asian governments, developing their infrastructure for... Yep. So anyhow, Craig at that time had become a very visible teacher in Shambhala, then Dharavadra Dhatu, had begun to experience some success with his gay-led retreats. He would bring together, usually through local Dharmadhatu Shambhala groups, collections of people, gay people, male and female, who wanted to come together around the gay theme. And Craig himself had evolved a kind of a whole philosophical view of gay Dharma, which personally for me always went a little bit over my head. But it really fueled his enthusiasm to think of gayness, queerness as a path of Dharma. And he basically went around leading these gay Dharma weekends and attracting a lot of followers all over the country, primarily in the larger urban Shambhala centers. And let's say this is around late 80s, early 2000s. Now, Craig and I, all through those years, had been close friends. So eventually I came on board with him doing some of those, and he asked me to be a meditation instructor at some of them. And so I began to get connected with what he was doing there and experience some of those retreats, Fire Island, Karma Choling, etc. And I began to experience the merit of them, the validity of them, the goodness of them, which was really kind of surprising to me. Because from a distance, I thought Craig was running his trip and these people were coming together to cheerlead about their gay identity. And I looked a little bit down at the whole idea of it. But the closer I got to it and the more involved I got in what was actually what was going on there, the more genuine it seemed to me. And the more it actually did fit my standard for what would be genuine Dharma teachings, genuine Dharma practice. So I felt it passed my test.
It passed your test.
Yeah. And that was a result of being involved in quite a few of them with Craig.
And they were ecumenical from the point of view that they would have Zen people and they could have different kinds of contemplative traditions involved.
For sure.
So it wasn't just a Shambhala thing. There were all sorts of contemplative traditions.
That is for sure, right. In fact, Craig had made a point, as this process was developing, of keeping it disconnected from Shambhala institutionally. But having Shambhala centers be the host for the programs, but that organizationally, institutionally... It would be independent, yeah. And he was well on the road to creating an organization that was free of Shambhala, but which had a close connection to Shambhala and which was hosted by Shambhala, so that there was always a venue for these retreats to take place.
Of which there is a tradition. I mean, you have Nalanda being a separate organization, you know, and then you have Naropa, and you have, you know, the Vajradhatu Sun when it became the Shambhala Sun, and then you have now Buddha Dharma and so on. They're related.
Yeah.
But they're separate.
Yeah.
And that's an important thing that we have always worked with, the need to have almost civil society organizations that are independent, but they're part of the community.
Right. And what went along with that was, as you pointed out, the ecumenical outlook of welcoming all traditions in, that didn't necessarily have to be a Buddhist path at all, even though it was... The fundamental practice of it was sitting meditation, and the wisdom that was being taught there was coming out of Craig's and the other meditation instructors' Buddhist experience. Yes, but everybody was welcome. The doors were completely open in the spirit of the Vijayadhara. You know.
You know, one of the retreats that I did experience in Fire Island. Goodness, it must have been 2003, maybe?
Yeah, we were at that together.
Right, and we were teaching. And what was interesting, just to tell our listeners, we rented a hotel and turned what was a disco, I believe, into a meditation hall. And being the end of the summer season, it was October, first weekend of October, second. So it was the end of the Fire Island season. And it was mostly men, New York City men with a few women. And what was interesting is when you began to listen to the many stories of the lives of these people who were practicing, you really became aware of the kind of recuperating from all that partying that we were talking about. Recuperating in terms of addictions, recuperating in terms of death, the AIDS epidemic, and people losing their partners or themselves. Being HIV positive, it was like the next wave, and I think that the Dharma in terms of Maitri and becoming friends with yourself was a very important, it's like you had gone through all the therapy to recuperate from, and you still perhaps were maintaining your relationships to AA or, you know, sexual addictions or whatever it is. But you needed something that was contemplative and almost had no words.
Yes.
And
yes,
the power
yes.
of no words to heal.
Yeah, right.
And
thus the attraction to this, to the meditation path.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And it was, I, you know, I've never sort of entered to many of the identity politics as such of queerness, partly because I went to a very radical college, Hampshire College, and everything was so radical identity, everything, that I probably, the only identity that I had was to be a Buddhist and a Cuban, right?
Mm-hmm.
And eventually gay, but I never, didn't really take it as an identity. But
mm-hmm.
I remember in that retreat, after we went for a walk and all sat down in the sunken forest, these chairs.
Oh, yeah.
I looked at that army of wonderful, mostly gay men and a few women sitting there looking at the nature of their minds and following their breath. And I felt it was almost a transcendental moment for me. It was like an army of gay warriors, you know, of warriors that happened to be living this path of the loneliness, specific loneliness of that world, as opposed to the specific loneliness of another one.
Yeah.
And I was so tremendously impressed.
Yeah.
They're wonderful retreats.
They were indeed.
And then we had this big party, right? We lowered the disco ball and
right.
danced to Gloria Gaynor.
Right. Yes.
And it happened to be Halloween, so earlier Halloween, but Halloween for Fire Island, so they had the transvestite, black big transvestite woman
yes.
that would show up.
Yes. She showed up during one of the talks, all dressed in red.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those were very powerful retreats and inspired a lot of gays onto the path.
Mm-hmm.
And this was fulfilling Craig's wish and vision that the gay retreats could become a gateway for people into the genuine path. And Craig even prepared everybody in his talks for unloading personal identity and not using the spiritual path as a way to solidify personal identity, be it gay or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So Craig really had that message.
Right.
To
have
to a large
accept
extent.
Yourself, but don't freeze it.
Yeah. Yeah. So the stage was set for by those retreats for a lot of people to go on the path, and a lot did, and a lot have. And there was a period there of excitement and novelty about those retreats, and a lot of the people who came to them thought, oh, this is wonderful, the fact that we can bring our genuineness to a gay environment. Usually the habitual past of being in a gay environment was that you had to put up some kind of a phony something or other. You know, you had to be looking your best, being your best. You had to be able to cruise. You had to be the most attractive, and you were attracted to the most attractive, and it was all about appearances, and you know that was what your gay experience was just full of. And now here was a relief where you could come together with gay people on different ground. Ground of genuineness, which was a spiritual path, right? And this created a whole lot of enthusiasm, and the novelty of that hung up there in the air for a long time, and it caused a lot of more smaller groups to form in city centers throughout the country, really.
Yeah, beautiful website. A beautiful website was very important, right?
Yeah.
And it was an identity, the website. It was very interesting.
You're talking about the
Queer
Dharma?
The Queer Dharma, yeah.
Yeah, Queer Dharma being the biggest one of them
yeah.
that formed in New York City. And at that time also, now let's say we're talking early 2000s here, I started one up in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the one that we called the Queer Buddhist Fellowship, the title of which met with some resistance.
Because it sounded...
Sounded too Episcopalian. And, too Protestant.
Uh-huh.
And... But we started it up, and there was an atmosphere of enthusiasm for this kind of thing. So it was quickly successful, And at the same time, another group in town called Buddha Buddies, which was part of the Zen Center, had just been kicked out of the Zen Center. They were a gay group that had been meeting at the Zen Center for maybe a couple of years prior to this. And they had basically been uninvited from the Zen Center because of various political arguments they were having. And they were causing a bad scene in the Zen Center. And the Zen Center decided they were going to stop inviting outside groups, even though they didn't want to be discriminatory.
Protecting their container, whichever way they define it.
Exactly.
They're there to do something, right?
Yeah, and right. there was a certain amount of infighting and arguing going on in this Buddha Buddies gay group.
In a Dharma group? Infighting? Arguing? No.
So those people, at the time we were starting up
Queer Dharma Fellowship?
Yeah.
But by then it was LGBT?
Well, we weren't LGBT yet.
All right.
We were still the Queer Buddhist Fellowship for quite a few years, really. But a lot of those people then came over to us because the doors had been closed to them at the Zen Center. While at the same time, Shambhala Center was now opening its doors. I had approached the board of directors of Shambhala Center asking them to invite us to give their permission for this to be an outside group that was not representing Shambhala, but was a guest of Shambhala. And they all gave it their blessing, and they thought it was a very nice idea. It went along with Shambhalian ideas of being inclusive socially, right? So everybody on the board approved, and they approved partly because they knew me, and they knew I was the one who would be starting it, and I was already a known quantity in Shambhala, having been...
Well, a respected practitioner, and a scholar, and you know your stuff, and...
Yeah, I filled the profile of what they wanted for a person who would lead any program in Shambhala, that it would be handled responsibly and properly. So they put their okay on it, and we went forward, and it was immediately successful. A lot of people from Buddha Buddies in Cambridge, from the Zen Center, came into our group and made their presence known right away, and also wanted to step in and help. Hmm. And so we were obviously on a roll at that point. We formed a board of, I think we called it a steering committee of about five people, and one or two of whom were from Buddha Buddies, and we gradually developed a vision and a plan for, what do you call it, a mission statement for what we stood for, and we put up a web page. And
can you recall anything that you stood for?
We stood for providing... And this is where Craig's vision and my vision diverged a bit. Basically, we were providing for gay and lesbian people to meet on the ground of spiritual path in safe space.
Mm-hmm.
And we did not have a philosophy or a view of what gay dharma was.
Right. No, because, when you think about it, if you have... Bushido, and you have Kyudo, and you have Kado, which is a tradition of turning whatever you do into a way, to a path. You could have Queerdo, I suppose, is what Craig was trying to do, but you were just trying to create a safe meeting space.
That's right, right.
Where the point wasn't...
It was all about dharma.
You happen to be gay, but it was all about dharma.
That's right.
Right.
The emphasis was on traditional dharma, the way the dharma was being taught, primarily in Shambhala. However... That was only because I was the Shambhala person there. We did invite other speakers. We invited a Zen Roshi, James Ishmael Ford. He was he has, to this day, a group of practitioners that he leads in Newton, out of a church there. He's a funny character, a very interesting guy. And he came and gave us a Zen talk on practice. He himself is a family man, not gay, but he was just a gay sympathizer. He was just had the spirit of openness. And we had people come from the Insight Meditation Group to lead us at times. Our only focus was we decided that it would have to be Buddhist.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't going to try to be pan-spiritual. We weren't going to start including a Christian perspective and a Hindu perspective and all that. We weren't trying to be that ecumenical. We were trying to provide a Buddhist environment, but a very loosely defined Buddhist environment. So we had Shambhala teachings, we had insight teachings, we had Zen, and we once had an Allen Ginsberg night where we showed a video of the life of Allen Ginsberg, and so we had our past heroes. Some people read Oscar Wilde.
It's very mixed. I mean, it's men and women. I mean,
mixed. And that, by the way, was one of the very successful marks of the group, was that from the start, we were half and half male, female.
Yeah. And
yeah.
All ages, too. And,
yes.
And different colors. And I mean, I was very impressed the one time I addressed the audience that it really was a lot of different people, different genders, different gender identities.
Yeah.
Different ages, colors, sizes, shapes, forms.
Yeah, right. Very, very
diverse.
And, you know, and at our peak, we were getting, you know, crowds of 40 people there normally. Now, what happened was it did peak. You know, we had, that was what I call the golden age of it, which lasted for probably 3 or 4 years, and that was when I was leading it. But then what began to happen was the novelty wore off.
Right.
The thrill was gone, and it became a regular thing that people might or might not go to.
The dirty nappies part.
Yeah. And the support for it began to fall away. And that, by that I meant the volunteerism, people wanting to step in and help. That became more and more spotty, so that it, more and more of the running of it, getting the donuts there, setting up the snacks, setting up the greeting table, making the name tags, taking the donations, all fell to me, such that try as I did to get volunteers to step into these roles, it was always unreliable, and I was beginning to wear out at it, so I began to look for a way to get out, and not finding the support. And Bruce Cole,
mm-hmm,
had
wonderful
been
Bruce,
a regular attendee, and I asked him if he'd be interested in taking over the leadership of it. Bruce had been in Shambhala, going way through Shambhala levels at that point. He himself had become a known person and a respected person in the Shambhala world at that point. He was a natural to take it over, and he did.
And the Shambhala world connection being the fact that they host you, so you have to have, even though it's ecumenical, they host you. So you have
at
to
that
have someone.
Point, yes,
yeah.
Right. However, under Bruce, and at the time of that transition, Shambhala began to step in and say, we think this should become a either, to stay here, this should be become a Shambhala program.
Buddhist.
A Shambhala
yeah,
Buddhist
right.
program. No more individuality. No more separation. So we were given the word, and that it had to come under the umbrella of Shambhala. This was under the direction of Lodro
Rinzler,
who was the leader of Shambhala Center at that time. So this is when I was stepping out of it. Anyhow, I was not very involved in that, but I was getting the news from Bruce that that we would not have this autonomy so much anymore.
But, which is something that's happening in Shambhala in general, not just in relation to LGBT, but in general, they're trying to tighten the boundaries around it.
Yes, right. So we had built up a little savings account of some money that we kept in a box to pay visiting teachers and things like that, and I formally turned that over to the center and said, okay, now it belongs to you guys. And they took our money, and that was sort of a gesture of the transition, you know, that now all the money that would come in, donations from the group, would go to Shambhala. It used to be that we'd give some to Shambhala to pay the rent, and we'd keep some for ourselves.
To run your organization.
Yeah, right. Okay, so that separation ended. And Bruce led the group for a couple of years. Up until about a year, year and a half ago, Bruce decided that he was having the same problem. And long story short, turned it over to Craig and Alyssa.
Craig
Sonnenberg and Alyssa Marino, who now run it, now lead the group. They are far less experienced in Shambhala than Bruce Cole was or I was. But they have the old enthusiasm that got the thing going in the first place. So they're doing very well. They are attracting large groups.
Great.
I'm personally out of touch with the group now, but I hear they're doing very well. And Shambhala is not telling them what to do. They can do whatever they want to, basically.
That's good.
They are following pretty much...
They pay the rent.
Yeah. They are pretty much following the path of the under 30 group and the recovery group.
Mm-hmm.
Which are left to their own devices, you know. Now, the only restriction I know of now that is put on the group is that their teachers have to be Shambhala teachers.
Mm.
I'm not sure how much of a limitation is put on who they can invite, you know, what outside teachers they can invite. I think there's some limitations there, you know.
Mm-hmm. And then there's also Outbreath, right?
Outbreath is an outbreath outgrowth of these various trends, which is recognizing, is because there's a recognition of the many different little gay Dharma groups, LGBT Dharma groups that exist throughout the metropolitan area. They were trying to find an umbrella way to keep those groups in touch with each other. So Outbreath was formed as mostly a website that...
keeps information and everybody knows where they can go and so on and so forth.
Right, yeah.
It's kind of like an invisible web of the ecumenical aspect that once ruled, once was part of the movement.
Yeah.
It's, you know, extraordinary if you Google, you know, queer Dharma or gay Buddhists, and it's almost in every city, and now it's becoming subspecialized, you know, the queer Dharma women or...
Yeah,
you know,
splinter groups,
and
yeah.
it's quite extraordinary. But what's so nice about it is, I think that the pioneering work in some ways that you and Craig did, and the people that worked with you, opened the conceptual space to consider this experiment. And I think that it's in many different ways provided an entry point. For gay people who want to have gay buddies who meditate.
Absolutely, absolutely.
You know,
and that continues to be a strength to this day, because a lot of the people who come in to the gay group who have an interest in the spiritual path, often through the teachings of, say, Pema Chodron, they're attracted to the idea of the spiritual path. They identify themselves as gay. They want gay connections. They want spiritual connection. And here they defined it in one place. And this has been the strength of the group, such that a good many people who have come in through this gateway have in fact gone on to do Shambhala trainings, and they've become more on the path.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
To close the interview, if you have to think about the future of LGBT, queer Dharma, gay Buddhist fellowships and so on and so forth, if you have to think about the future, what would be your heart wish for what would happen in 25, 50, 100 years from the kind of little seed that you guys planted?
All I can think of is that it would be able to it would be provided with a space where it could continue to do this, could continue to be a gateway for people into the genuine spiritual path, so that it may be a wide net that attracts people for their own reasons, but then as they get more attracted to the idea of spiritual path, it becomes more the spiritual path and less their personal preference, you know. And that's, to me, defines the success of it. Is that it helps people to go in that direction.
Bill, I want to thank you, both personally and collectively, for all the work that you've done. and how difficult it is to every Sunday or every whatever, you know, find the donuts, etc., you know, the nappies part. And just keeping good heart and being so kind to people for so long, and creating a space for all of us to be young together, be middle-aged together, to be old together, and again to be young together. So, Bill Wooding, thank you.
Thank you.
You are listening to Mosaics on Chronicles Radio, a production of the Chronicles of Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. Support for this programming comes from our listening audience. To contribute, visit chroniclesradio.com and click on Support This Work. Thank you for your support, and thank you for listening to Chronicles Radio.